Bloomberg on the Economy with Michael McKee and Sarah Eisen. If you're listening via our new Bloomberg Radio Plus iPhone app, did you know you can also hear market updates on demand? Simply tap on Bloomberg Market Minutes. The reports are updated every half hour. If you don't have the Radio Plus iPhone app yet, you'll want to download it. It's free via the iTunes App Store.
Barry Ritholtz, he's our guest for the hour, CEO, Director of Equity Research, Fusion IQ, runs the Big Picture blog, very well known on Wall Street. Wall Street is in rally mode. The DAX is up 5%, Barry, going into the close here, 11:30 Eastern time in Europe.
Yes.
Is this for real?
Well, put this into context. You know, the U.S. bourses haven't even fallen 20% from their recent peaks. The DAX was, what, 7,500 back in July, and it plummeted down to about 5,000. It lost a third of its value.
Yeah, it's still down 19% for the year.
Yeah, so if you look at how far, that's a huge drop in 6 months. That spring gets so tight that when it finally unwinds on any hope of a relief rally, that's what you end up with. Look at the U.S. markets. We've pulled back to the August lows, found a little support there, and bounced. The question is this just a dead cat bounce, a little bit of relief rally, or perhaps the start of something more lasting?
Well, let me ask you about Europe, because you, more than most people, follow every little bit of news that comes out for your blog. Where's this coming from? None of the major news organizations, not in the Times, not in the Journals, not in the FT, it's not on Bloomberg, it's not on Reuters, and everybody's talking about a $2 trillion package that nobody is reporting.
Well, you know, trading rumors and things that ping from desk to desk by IM are always been out there. There was a story we heard yesterday that a major $20-plus billion hedge fund was being liquidated, and now that the liquidation ended last week. By the way, no one has stepped forward. No one's validated this or verified this. But this hedge fund that supposedly had big holdings in precious metals and financials, now that that liquidation was done, the selling pressure abates and everything rallies. I look askance at all these things. They're always after the fact, you know, rationales, as opposed to, hey, sometimes the market just eventually exhausts itself in one direction and reverses and heads the other direction. The day-to-day action has such a heavy element of noise, it's really hard to pull some valid signal out of it.
So you're looking at a valid signal going forward in earnings?
Yes, absolutely. Here are the data, and this comes from a couple of studies. One is from McKinsey. The other is from a frequent guest of yours, Jim Bianco of Bianco Research. First, McKinsey's long-term studies have found Wall Street analysts as a whole, when they're looking forward a year, are always overestimating earnings estimates. The consensus tends to be two times what the actual growth rate of earnings are. That goes back 25 years. It's pretty consistent. The only time they underestimate is right in the depth of the recession, when they should be flipping the other way. So that sort of groupthink for most of the trend is right, but at the turning points, it's wrong. The Bianco research was really fascinating. He looked at how much are earnings estimates wrong heading into a recession. And he found three distinct time periods, three distinct degrees that the consensus has been off. Post-World War II, before the year 2000, heading into a recession, the estimates were about 15% too high. That typically translates into about a 20% market correction during the recession, as earnings, basically the market chases earnings down to where they actually are as opposed to where they were perceived to be. 2001, dot-com crash, a little bit unusual. Earnings estimates were 25% too high heading into that recession. Some people have kind of excused it, saying, hey, you know, this was a massive dot-com collapse. It's not a surprise. People got it wrong. The problem is most of the dot-com stocks that crashed had no earnings, so it really shouldn't have impacted estimates. And 08, truly an outlier in the mid-40%, about 44%, overestimating the earnings as we head into that recession. Clearly, once credit freezes, once the wheels of the economy grind to a halt, whatever estimate you have is going to be wildly, wildly off. That translated into a 57% drop in the S&P, some of which was earnings related and some of which was just sheer panic.
Well, the latest numbers show for the second quarter, S&P 500 earnings up 16.2%. Ex-financials were up 18.9%. The numbers for the third quarter are 14.5% and 14.6%. Given the slowing of the economy, is that wildly optimistic for the current quarter that we're just ending?
It possibly could be. I don't think we have enough clarity to definitively say, hey, we're definitely heading into a recession. I raised my odds over the past 6 months from 30% to 40%, and we're now at about 50%. It's about an even money possibility. By the way, the alternative isn't necessarily so attractive. 0.5% to 1% GDP, skirting a recession, just sort of an anemic muddle through economy, which is pretty much what Reinhart and Rogoff's work suggests. Coming out of a post-credit crisis, that's what we should really be looking at, a soft growth, soft job creation. Because the S&P 500, especially the big companies, are deriving so much growth from overseas and are operating so lean and so efficient, their balance sheets are about as good as they've been over the past 50 years, they seem to be better situated for whatever comes next, whatever recession or contraction comes next, certainly better than they were in 2008 and probably better than they were in 2001.
So are they still overvalued at this point, given that outlook? Or?
It really depends. You know, I hate when I ask questions and people say, well, it depends. You know, if
we're
we,
used to that.
If we have – so I'll, rather than give you the depends, I'll give
on
you the either
hand,
or.
Yeah.
On one hand, if we have that 0.5%, 1% GDP and earnings growth manages to gain 5 or 10% or even stays flat, it's hard to say that markets aren't fairly valued here. However, if we have another uptick in unemployment, if we have another down leg in real estate delinquencies and foreclosures, you know, the best guesstimate is we're 5 million foreclosures 5 years from the 06 mm-hmm. peak, probably about halfway through a 10-year recovery period, and
yeah.
three-quarters of the way through to 7 million, 8 million, 9 million foreclosures. That'll really pressure the banks. That'll pressure a number of other things. And you could see –
it'll be ugly.
You could see a $70 or $80 yeah. number on the S&P earnings. That said, you know, I'm not a big believer that we need to have a seven times multiple
to get there. One of the things that Barry has done recently is interesting on the Big Picture blog. Bloomberg Markets Magazine did a Bloomberg 50, the 50 most influential people in the financial world. You asked your readers – what they thought. They came up with a slightly different list. You've
yes.
got the Big Picture 30. Very interesting, and I'll send people to www.ritholtz.com to see this list. But the people on it tend to be bearish and contrarian
yes.
compared with the more mainstream people in the Bloomberg list. Why do you suppose
the
that
doomsayers.
Is?
Well, first, it was supposed to be the Big Picture 50, but it was like a 32-way tie for the last 20 slots, so I kind of left it like that. There's some people that are definitely bearish, but you know, I look at people like Bob Shiller or Laxman Athershan under Strategist, not exactly bearish.
But you know, you look at this list, there are a lot of bears that stand out in some of the more bearish leaning blogs and voices. And you know, we're in a bearish time right now. We're in somewhat of a recession, even though we're not technically in one. It feels like one. And the news continues to get worse from Europe. And you heard, you know, Lynn of the conference board saying that it for consumers, it feels like recession times. Sounds
well,
like that's a facet of this.
The economy, the economic recovery, and we have had a economic recovery of sorts. It's been very lumpy and unevenly distributed. And the parts of the economy that have done the best are those that receive the most amount of government aid. So if you look at Wall Street has actually done pretty well the past couple of years. Bonuses have been pretty strong. Earnings have been pretty strong, despite the fact that they're carrying all this junky paper still. If you look at the automobile industry was rescued by a bailout, that would have been toast. It seems to have improved. Look at housing. As bad as housing has been, you had the mortgage modifications, the foreclosure abatements, and, of course, the first-time homebuyer's tax credit. Notice that as each of these sectors have moved away from the end of the government bailouts or aids or tax breaks, that sector has done worse and worse. A lot of what's been taking place in this post-credit crisis recovery has been very soft, very government-driven. And it really points out that the European model of Irish austerity and what they're eventually going to foist on Italy and Greece, that form of austerity. I know that there's this big Hayek versus Keynes. Not only is it a philosophical debate, it's also a rap debate. There's a viral video that's gone around. but really, you know, I understand both schools of thought. I think they both have their positives and negatives. If we want to go Austrian or Austerian, as a friend calls it, you have to accept the fact that it's a 5 to 10 year process of wringing out the excess. And no sitting politician wants to wait a decade for the economy to come back around. It will eventually, if we do nothing, heal itself. Economies are really good that way. It's almost Darwinian in how capital gets reallocated to the best user. But it's a really painful process. And what ends up happening is, as it gets worse, if you're going to make that decision, you got to agree to it and stick with it. We don't have the discipline as a nation to do that. So as you get into the depths of panic, you end up with stuff like TARP and bailouts and all sorts of what I think are highly misguided policies.
So you look at a gajillion stories go across the web every single day. Mm-hmm. What is the most under the radar one that's out there right now that you're paying pretty close attention to?
That's a really interesting question.
I just thought of it.
Let's think about that. When you say least under the radar, that nobody knows about?
We talk about the same stuff all the time on this show. I'm trying to mix it up.
Okay, so let's mix it up.
We know about the Fed. We know about Europe.
So first, I don't know if this is under the radar. There are the rumors about the 7X, 9X European authority coming out with this new bailout that'll be the equivalent of trillions. I think it's just a nonsensical rumor. That's been bouncing around a great deal. Everybody knows about the Apple story. There's not a whole lot to talk about there. At a certain point, the question becomes, has the bearishness become too excessive? Have we reached a point where we have to go the other way? There's been some stuff along those lines, but nothing that's really been definitive. Probably the single most interesting story, the one that – and I mentioned this in passing yesterday – we've been following the MERS housing story, which is this mortgage electronic registration that was formed by a consortium of banks and Fannie and Freddie. It's been an ongoing headache. The Dallas district attorney filed a lawsuit against them, and this is something we've been waiting to have happen broadly, suing in order to collect for the recording fees that's supposed to be filed every time a mortgage changed hands. You know, MERS is not anything that's formally approved by legislation. And what the law is, and it varies from state to state, county to county, is when a mortgage changes hands, you have to file a recording with the local county, and you have to pay a fee. In New York, it's 0.8%, which on the average $200,000 mortgage is a chunk of change. And so think about what happened with MERS and with all this syndication. This mortgage may have changed hands 10 or 20 times, no fee ever paid. And so the Dallas County DA, amongst other district attorneys, filed this litigation looking for tens of millions of dollars back. I think that a number of counties and states are going to do the same. We've already seen some of these lawsuits start. In theory, those fees should be enough to bankrupt MERS, put them out of business. And the question becomes, was this done with fraudulent intent from day one so that you could penetrate this corporate veil held by Bank America and Citigroup and Fannie and Freddie and go after their assets to recover? Stop and think about this. This is just a giant scam, a giant paper shuffle that – in these times of economic distress with cities, states, municipalities really tight, they're turning over seat cushions looking for every last dime. If it turns out that a consortium of banks owes most of these local counties millions of dollars, this litigation can get really, really interesting.
Where does it take us?
It takes us back to the question of rogue banks, not rogue traders, but rogue banks. My belief has been any bank that engages in a wholesale, broad illegality should suffer the fate that Arthur Andersen suffered, that Enron suffered. You cannot have robo-signing banks, and you cannot have this – notice the parallels. You can't have a chain of different companies and outside consultants doing illegalities to try and shield the bank. When you hire a law firm and they foreclose on people who bought their house with cash and don't have a mortgage, that's a technical impossibility. The only way that can happen is if there's fraud, and not just like, oops, a little bit of fraud, systemic rampant fraud within the system. It's unfortunate that Congress has been corrupted by Wall Street money. Don't expect any investigation from them. They sold out a long time ago. The hope was the state DAs would be able to do something. And other than a handful of DAs, they've been persuaded that, oh, if you do this, it's bad for the economy. Hey, the last time I looked, allowing banks to engage in fraud is bad for the economy. It's bad for confidence. It makes people think that they can't get a fair shake. In New York, Eric Schneiderman has been pretty robust in going after the banks. We're starting to see the states that had real problems, Arizona, Las Vegas, California, moving in a similar direction. And if you look in Florida, they were moving in the same direction. And then what ended up happening, the new attorney general got elected and actually fired the two investigators who put together this really brutal analysis of how much fraud there was in the various foreclosures. It was pretty well known that not only was there fraud, but it had to be known by a decent number of senior executives. It couldn't have been a rogue employee. It had to be pretty systemic from a high way up. I think this story is going to continue to have legs, and it's going to continue to spread as states and counties and municipalities say, they cheated us out of how many millions of dollars? Yeah. By the way, this isn't a contract where you agree and, oh, afterwards you have buyer's remorse. This is, wait, you moved that mortgage how many times? Well, yeah, you owe us this much money.
Well, on this theme of banks and, well, it's not fraud, but certainly risk-taking, we want to get your thoughts on the Federal Reserve and what sort of policies they've been implementing. You told us during the break, the more we get from the Fed, the less effective it is.
Right. I mean, there's only so much of an impact that each quantitative easing is going to have. You know, if you look at the problems in the economy, I don't think anyone can honestly say, well, if only rates were a little lower, everything would be fine. At this point, you know, the 30-year mortgage is 3.99. That's just unprecedented. So if that rate isn't stimulating housing activity and a teeny bit of refinance activity, right, there are other issues. There are two levers government has to impact economies coming out of a recession. One is monetary. We've pretty much done just about everything you're going to do in terms of monetary action. The other is fiscal. If we have a QE3, the problem is that's potentially inflationary, that punishes savers. It has an impact on people who are living on a fixed income, on retirees. It's somewhat of a zero-sum game. Whoever you're helping, you're redistributing stuff, you're helping hurting somebody else. So if we want to do something, and I'm not suggesting that's the correct approach, but if we don't want to just let the economy naturally cleanse itself over the next decade, monetary policy isn't the solution. It's got to be some form of fiscal policy. And as of today, it looks like there's zero appetite for that in D.C. So, you know, expect the Reinhardt and Rogoff 10-year recovery period to be about as long as it takes, if we're lucky. Remember, Japan's now on the beginning of their third lost decade. They had the 90s, the 2000s. We'll see how much further they're going to go. They have a very different economy, a very different demographic picture than the United States. I think we're better off than them, although their export picture is tremendous. Their balance of trade picture is strong. This could take a full decade to work our way through.
Got about a minute and a half left here. Let me take the next step from these comments, both about fiscal and monetary policy, and ask, how do you think this is going to play out as we go into the election year 2012? Do we see 434 new members of the House? Is this going to be one of those wave, throw-the-bums-out elections?
You know, there's the history of the electorate disliking Congress but liking their own congressmen. It's a relatively easy job to keep unless, you know, you're going to not pander to people, and then it becomes a little more challenging. As we go through the next year, it's pretty clear the voting public is disenchanted with Obama. On the other hand, it doesn't appear that the Republicans have put up anybody that has staying power of more than a couple of weeks. You had Michelle Bachmann was a favorite. Rick Perry, who you guys reported not too long ago, numbers are starting to plummet in the polls. It may very well end up being President Mitt Romney by default as the least objectionable politician at this point. Yet when you see the calls for Chris Christie and other such things, let's get more people in this. Listen, how many – someone described it the other day as star search in reverse. Each week you get more and more candidates as opposed to less and less. At this point, it's anybody's race to lose. There's no doubt Obama is very beatable. Let's see if the Republicans can put up a candidate who doesn't scare the independent voter, doesn't scare people who believe in science and evolution. I mean,
yeah.
That sort of stuff is embarrassing when you travel overseas. If I had to make a bet today, I would say there's a very, very strong chance Romney comes out of the nomination process and manages to beat Obama. The other guy I think who could beat Obama comes from Andy Borowitz, and he said the Obama who ran in 2008 would absolutely destroy the Obama who's running in 2012.
If we could perfect cloning.
That's right. There's something to be said about that.
Barry Ritholl, thank you. We should borrow from Tom Keene and do shameless plug for you October 11th. You're doing it at the New York Athletic Club.
Yes.
Big Picture Conference. A lot of great guests there. So we urge people to go to your blog, look that up.
A lot of Bloomberg
maybe,
on the economy.
Maybe sign up.
Listen to Bloomberg on the Economy weekdays at 11 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio, Channel 113. Copyright 2011.